This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk. Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
Hi, I'm Davina from Devon. I've been sober curious for quite a few years. Never really made it stick because, well, everybody drinks alcohol, right? Anyway, I decided to join OTI after listening to the pod and just the enthusiasm from Ben and Shaz shouting about AF life. I'm so glad I joined the community because I'm now nearly 200 days alcohol free. It's an absolute game changer for me. Everybody on the Zooms are lovely. It's just like one great big extended family and we're all just cheering everybody on. I would recommend without hesitation that you join because it's just the best thing I've ever done.
So if you want to join us, go to overtheinfluence.co.uk. Welcome once again to Over the Influence. This is, as Freddie would describe it, this is possibly the biggest and fastest growing alcohol-free podcast in the world right now. Probably comes with a little bit of a disclaimer and that emoji with the long nose. This second series is all about you and it's all about the guests that you want to hear on this podcast. And I'm just going to go in. I'm just going to be dead honest here. When I found out that our next guest said yes and he was going to agree to come on, I squealed. I was really excited about it. When you start out on an alcohol-free journey, one of the tools you're sort of advised to take on, aside from not picking up a drink, is arm yourself with Quit Lit, which are books about alcohol-free life. And one of the books at the top of that pile, it's Alcohol Explained. And the author of that book is William Porter. And it gives me the greatest pleasure to introduce William to Over the Influence today. And I'm going to start by saying, William, and this sounds cheesy and I don't care, your book changed my life.
I have to say that's the best introduction I've ever had.
It's good, isn't it? It's good.
Started on a high there.
But it's true. None of that was scripted. That is from the heart. And, you know, when you get this list of books, when you're starting out, stopping drinking, and I'll talk about how far on we are in a minute. I've got that excited that you're here. I've skipped out a whole load of information, but it'll come out during the course of the podcast. Yours is one of the first books that I read, and this is 2 years ago now. And it was so simple, and it does what it says on the tin. It explains alcohol. And I'm not joking when I say it really did change my life. So thank you for that as a starting point.
Pleasure. Glad it was useful.
So let's talk about you. Before we talk about the book and the things you cover, tell us about William Porter, the drinker, before you became William Porter, the author.
So I started drinking and smoking when I was 14, which is, it makes me feel old now, so this is back in like the 90s. So I'm 44 now. I think that works out from the maths. I mean, it was a different world with drinking and smoking then anyway. And I think, depending on what country you're talking to, 14 either seems very young or sort of par for the course. But I think in the UK, it's generally par for the course. So as I said, I started drinking and smoking. And then I came across Alan Carr's Easy Way to Quit Smoking fairly early on, in that I think I must have been like 16, 17, 18 when I first read it. And I was like really taken by it. I thought it was the best thing I'd ever come across, because up till then it was kind of like smoking wasn't really understood and any method of quitting was kind of like really airy-fairy and didn't really make much sense. But there was this book that suddenly kind of broke down all the nonsense and took a really pragmatic and in-your-face approach to smoking and kind of addiction generally. So I was really fascinated by it. It took me actually 4 or 5 years to quit, having read the book, in that I kept coming back to it and I kept reading more and more that Alan Carr had written. And I read his Only Way to Stop Smoking Permanently, which is a much thicker, more detail heavy book about addiction and smoking. And I eventually quit. And then I stopped smoking but carried on drinking. And my drinking increased over the next couple of decades, whatever it was. But I think I, not consciously, but just took Alan Carr's kind of analytical approach and just applied it to my own drinking. And that went on for, as I say, a couple of decades or so. So I was always a binge drinker. So we'd always go out at weekends and we'd drink to get drunk. That was the purpose of drinking. And that kind of went on for quite a few years. And not going too much into the backstory because it just gets ridiculous, but I ended up joining the Reserve Battalion of the Parachute Regiment at one point. And I, after 9/11 happened, everything sort of changed. And I ended up getting sent out to Iraq for 6 months, which was a bit of an it was a really strange thing because I didn't join intending to do that. I joined thinking it would be something, you know, a bit different to do on the weekends, and suddenly the world changed quite quickly and I was getting like fired out to Iraq for 6 months. It was, oh my God. So that escalated my drinking, I think, quite considerably. And by the time that finished and I got married and had children, I think further down the line, the binges just got longer and longer and longer. And it just was getting more and more and more out of hand. So eventually I quit for good in February 2014. And that was it really. Yeah. So it was a question of kind of ever escalating drinking and then quitting what was sort of about six and a half years ago now.
Amazing. Thank you for that. Before we pick up on all the, I've got a million points that we want to talk about on the podcast about the book, William. William, what I didn't explain at the beginning of the podcast, because as I said, I just got quite excited that you're here and, you know, wanted to get chatting to you. In a nutshell, just for people that are only just joining us maybe for the first time, I decided to go alcohol free. I've just celebrated 2 years now alcohol free, but I just started out giving myself a break of 90 days without alcohol. And I'm still doing that. You know, I've not looked back and I don't think I ever will, which is a point I'm going to raise with you in a bit. And Freddie, you've just hit, is it 550 days-ish, Freddie?
Yeah, I'm all the fives, 555 days alcohol-free. And yeah, thank you. And just like Shazza, I got to that stage when I hit that cliche point of saying I am sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I thought if I really want to live that life that I know I want to live, I need to stop doing something that I know you talk about, William. And I stopped needing to tell myself this story that I was being this very cool individual that was propping up the bar and sipping on a martini like James Bond, when I know anyone else that would see me would think I was just sort of spilling my drink down myself and falling on the floor. But I was telling myself this story about being so suave and cool and sophisticated and rock and roll. But really, I was just getting further and further away from that life that I really wanted to live. And that's why I thought I'm going to go 90 days without as well. And then I realized, hang on, maybe there's something to this. And that's when I found your books and the rest they say is history.
Fantastic. Did you two quit sort of together or was that just coincidence or?
We didn't know each other, did we, Shazza?
But no.
That was a whole, you know, we came together through our alcohol-free experiences. But no, when the irony is, in our drinking days, myself and Shazza didn't even know each other. I sometimes wonder
really
what that might
job.
Have been like.
And also, William, Ben, our producer, known as the enigmatic background Ben, we recorded an episode not so long ago. William, it's a bit too early to kick off with an argument in the episode just yet, but it was all about moderation. And Ben had this idea that moderation was possible, but I think I'll allow you to pick up, William, with your thoughts on that.
So that there's a huge amount. I could take up a whole hour on moderation alone. The fact of the matter is, though, the basic physiology with alcohol is it's a sedative, it's a chemical depressant, so it depresses or inhibits nerve activity. But your brain tries to maintain a chemical balance. So it's always, it's known as homeostasis, but it's just basically a chemical balance. So when you drink alcohol, which is a sedative, your brain tries to counter the sedating and depressing effects of the alcohol. It does this in lots of very, very complicated ways, but what it comes down to is it becomes essentially hypersensitive so that it can work while under the depressing, sedating effects of the alcohol. Okay, so when the alcohol then wears off, you've got a period of being overly sensitized, and that makes you feel, that's what anxiety is. It's that anxious, unpleasant feeling you get after you've been drinking.
It's horrific.
It's horrible. It really is unpleasant, and it's caused by the chemical imbalance by the previous drink. So one of the key and most obvious problems with moderation is, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So if you say to yourself, I'm not happy as I am, I need the sedating effects of an alcoholic drink, after 10, 15 minutes, whatever, that drink wears off. So, and it leaves a corresponding feeling of anxiety. So you need another drink to get rid of it, and another and another and another. And that's why it's so difficult when people start drinking to just have one or two, and why it always spirals into drinking loads and loads. It's because when a drink wears off, it creates the need for the next one. So I could talk all day about the psychological side of it as well, but the fact of the matter is, it's not like I'm hungry, I've eaten, I'm full and content. It's I want something, and when it wears off, I want it twice as badly as I did in the first place.
It makes sense. My dad used to say exactly the same thing about smoking. He'd say, imagine, you know, a straight line down the middle of the horizon. That's normal. That's where people who don't smoke exist, on that line. You have a cigarette and you're on the line, and then the effects wear off and you just drop below and below and below that line until you have another fag and it brings you back up again. So basically, you're creating something for yourself where you constantly need it just to get back to normal.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Yeah. So that, I mean, that's the obvious problem. And I think the other problem from a practical perspective is, so I've quit drinking, so I spend loads of my time thinking about drinking because of what I do, but I spend zero time thinking about whether I ought to have a drink or not, because I don't drink. And whether I'm out with friends, whether I'm at home, whether it's Christmas, I'm on holiday, whatever, I don't drink, and that just never enters my realm of possibility. Whereas when you're moderating, I think you can end up obsessing with alcohol as much as you ever did when you were drinking as much as you wanted to, because every situation is a should I, shouldn't I? And it almost, it's catch 22 where you cannot win, because if you successfully moderate for a day, a week, a month, whatever, the next time it comes to have a drink, it's that much easier to say, you know what, I'm going to let myself have one because I'm in control. And so it just, you can't win with it, because sooner or later you will get to the point where you overdo it again because of that chemical nature, and you're right back to square one. And it's almost, the more successful you are, the more you're setting yourself up for a fall, as I say, because it becomes easier and easier to say, well, you know what, last Friday I only had two and Saturday I only had two, so, you know, I can have one even though it's only Wednesday night or Tuesday night or whatever. But you're on the same slippery slope you were on to begin with.
William, when I read the first book, Alcohol Explained, that was where the penny dropped for me about moderation. It wasn't that I was crap. It wasn't that I was weak. It wasn't that I was unable to have one or two. It explained to me why I couldn't have one or two, why I couldn't moderate. So I got then that moderation didn't exist. From book two, which I read in Abersock just a couple of weeks ago, because it was absolutely lashing down, so we were confined to the holiday cottage with my reading. So I was reading the second book, which recaps some of the first and brings in some new pointers on how to stay away from alcohol, how to, you know, keep on not drinking. And there was one thing that really struck me, and it's when me and Freddie talk to our friends and things, and they go, oh, when are you drinking? And we go, well, we're not drinking for now, okay? I always sort of, I say, I'm not drinking for now. And I always end it on that. And I've always thought, why the hell do I do that? I don't think I've got any intention of drinking. And in your book, you say here, I don't drink, simple. That is a given. I've made the decision not to take it ever again. And you refer to it like a drug, not to take that drug ever again. And at that point, I thought, you know what? He's done it again. William Porter's in my brain. I'm going to start saying, I don't drink. I don't need to end it with for now.
No, exactly. Yeah, I think, because what you were saying is quite interesting, because both of you started by saying, I'll do a 90-day period and just see how it goes. And it's always, it's really difficult to give advice on this point, because a lot of people thinking of the entire rest of their lives not drinking is almost too big to contemplate. And like 90 days is very good because you're kind of saying, well, you know what? I'm going to dip my toe in the water. I'm going to see how it goes for 90 days. And if it's done properly, what you will find is life is just so much better not drinking. Oh. It just doesn't compare.
Yeah.
So there's no way you'd ever want to go back to it. I think you can go in it the wrong way, where you're kind of looking at it, it's hard work and you avoid social occasions and you just sit there waiting for that period to be up. But I think if you really want to get the best out of it, there is a different dynamic. And I think the trouble is with set periods, you can almost make a penance for yourself in that it's like a sort of a carrot and stick thing where you're sort of constantly chugging on to the next point, the next milestone, whatever it happens to be, as opposed to just saying to yourself, you know what, I'm done with it. Because I think a lot of the problems with quitting drinking is we see it tastes good, it's fun, you enjoy a night out way more when you have a drink, you know, it helps you relax, it helps you sleep. We've got all these core beliefs about them, and I think when you see it for what it is, you realize that all of those are just nonsense. They're complete and utter nonsense. It is, in essence, it's a sedative that we happen to take in a drink form rather than injecting it or snorting it. It's that simple. And we don't need it to enjoy our lives.
Ben, that's really interesting for you because you've set out, haven't you, on a 90-day break?
Yeah, I'm 2 months in at the moment. But I started off the year, William, with a moderation plan. Because
here we go.
Basically, I got to a point in my life where I was drinking unnecessary drinks, is what I call them. So the obvious ones, when you go out to the pub on a Friday night with your mates, you're going to have a few pints. But then in the job I was in, someone would come across from a different office, so I'd go out for a pint at lunchtime or go out with the team after work. And it was just so many drinks that I was drinking unnecessarily. Like they weren't enhancing the experience. So I basically wanted to cut those out. And I came up with a very catchy title of 20 in 2020. Right. I had, before all this nonsense, you know, turned the world upside down, I had a stag do for my best friend I was best man for, and then his wedding. My brother was turning 30, and I wanted to cut down on my alcohol, but I didn't necessarily want to cut it out completely. I've got to say, being now 2 months into it, properly going none at all, it is amazing. Like, it is incredible. Yes. How different I'm already starting to feel. Like, since the heaviest I was in lockdown, I've lost nearly a stone and a half in weight. My business is going well. My girlfriend's really proud of me. My mom mentioned it the weekend. So, I want to see kind of how well you did with it before I mentioned it to you. But, you know, I'm really proud of you. Well done. You look better and healthier. Jem said to me this morning, my girlfriend, because I was talking about, actually, I think, you know, 3 months is on the horizon, but I think I'm just going to keep going. And she said, don't take this the wrong way, but you're a much nicer person to be around. So even just 2 and a bit months in, like having it completely out of my system, I was skeptical, to be perfectly honest. And these two guys encouraged me to do the 3 months. And now I know why Shaz gets so excited about it all.
Yes, yes.
I think that's one of the things that I keep trying to say to people, but I think you have to live it to truly appreciate it, is that not drinking is better than drinking. But better than even, because everyone says, well, of course, yeah, you don't want to wake up with a hangover. It's not very nice. But I'm like, no. It's better than any part of your drinking life. Even when you sit down after a horrible day at work and crack open that ice cold beer, or, you know, you get on holiday and you sit down by the pool and have what you think is the best possible experience with alcohol, not drinking is better. Because you're going back to what Ben was saying about you're having that cigarette to get back to normal. You're already at normal. You've got the boost all the time, and you don't need alcohol to relieve the previous withdrawal from it.
I wanted to ask, take a different approach, William, and maybe take a more of a controversial approach, because as we always say on Over the Influence, we'd like to say it how it is and not sugarcoat it. So we speak to a lot of people that, you know, may get to a year without any alcohol. And then, as we said, they'll tell themselves it's going to be different now and they can have a few drinks and then it all goes a bit wrong. I've got to be honest, I don't even know if Shazza and Ben know this. So I'm over 555 days now. This last week, I've started having the C word in my mind, and that word being Christmas. And I found myself saying, you know what? Christmas is going to come around quickly. It's been a tough year. You've proved your point. I'll have done almost 2 years by that stage. Maybe then I'll just have one. And then I'll catch myself and be thinking, what am I saying? Because we know everything around it. But it's almost, I don't know if riskier is the right word, but there's something there around, we tell ourselves we've proved a point, we know things are better, but that little demon still creeps in there sometimes and says, right, but you would still quite like one sometimes. I think a lot of our listeners sometimes have that as well, even though they've gone for a long period without a drink.
Yeah, there's so much to say about that. I think, so bearing in mind that the problem with alcohol is that we have these beliefs that we need it to have fun, we need it to enjoy Christmas, and the fact is we don't. But in terms of being bombarded daily with messages that we do need it, alcohol is, you know, by far head and shoulders above any other drug in existence, because social media, adverts, TV, all of them have got people drinking on and relaxing and drinking and having fun drinking and all the rest of it. So you're constantly bombarded by those images. And there's two other reasons why sobriety, if I can call it that, tends to get weaker over time. In fact, there's a few reasons, but I'll go through a couple of the main ones. One is fading effect bias, which is, it's a universal human trait to look back on past events more positively than they were when they actually happened. So when you look back on the past, you generally see it more positively. The interesting thing is, it is universal. And by universal, I mean, it's not just exhibited in Western society. Every possible culture on the globe, every human being has this tendency. So when we quit drinking, as we move into the future, we're more and more inclined to look back on our drinking years fondly and think, oh, it wasn't as bad as I thought. And we forget the hangovers. We forget waking up in the middle of the night feeling anxious. We forget feeling exhausted all day and having to drag ourselves around. And we remember what we think of as the fun parts, sitting on holiday or Christmas or all the rest of it. And we tend to hone in on those things, which is, again, if you just stop and think about the reality of it, going back to what Ben was saying about all the drinks you drink, and actually, you know, it's only the one or two that you think you actually enjoy anyway. But when this tendency kicks in, we just focus in on what we think of as the, you know, the fun things, the enjoyable things. And there's another tendency, which I call it ambition, but it's just a human tendency to want to better ourselves. But it's made up of two distinct things. We're critical of what we have, and we tend to idolize what we don't have. So again, that's great, and it drives us to want to better ourselves and do more and greater things, whatever. But the problem is, when we apply it to addiction, it works against us, because when we're drinking, we don't like it and we want to stop and we crave to be sober. But when we stop drinking, we then start looking at drinking and idolizing it. So I think there's those two tendencies. What I would say specifically about Christmas is, for me, it always comes back to just looking at the reality of it and stripping away all the nonsense and all the hype. So Christmas is fun. It's a nice time of year. Well,
well, it might not be this year. It might be cancelled.
I was going to say it's a time to spend with your family, but that's assuming you like your family and want to spend time with them, which isn't true for everyone. But really, all the alcohol is, it's just a sugary drink with a poison in it that makes you feel slightly dulled for 10 minutes before making you feel correspondingly anxious. And that's it. So strip away all the nonsense, and that's what you're left with.
William, some of the people that are listening now to this, they won't be as far down the alcohol-free route as myself and Freddie and Ben. You know, and I'm never going to ever use the word only 2 months. Those 2 months, Ben, are already changing your life, I think it's fair to say. You're already feeling and seeing the benefits, and you'd look really well because of it. But I've got to say, William, it takes so long. It's taken me 2 years to get to the point now where I actually view alcohol, as you say here, it's a fairly pathetic little drug. And as Freddie just, you know, talked about there, he still has those romantic connections of that first cold beer, that first nice glass of wine. It's taken me forever, and I'm still learning and still reading and still researching. It takes a long time to get to that point is the point I'm trying to make, which took me ages to get to that point.
Yeah, no, it does take a long time. And as I say, because we're bombarded with the nonsense and the hype constantly, it's almost like painting the fourth bridge. You can't just say, right, I've stopped and that's it. Because over time, you're still bombarded with all these nonsensical images of people out drinking and, you know, you have to have a drink to enjoy a night out and all the rest of it. Yeah, it's just ongoing, I think, and it does take time. And I think the problem is as well, when you're a regular drinker, it's even harder because you're almost, your existence is, you're either in the withdrawal, which means that you are feeling anxious and not particularly pleasant and a bit out of sorts, or you're drinking, in which case everything's fine. And it's, the dynamic works the wrong way around, because it's when you're drinking that you feel confident and happy. And when you're not drinking, that you start to feel anxious and tired and all the rest of it. So it's very difficult, I think, for people who are still in that vicious circle. I think it's easy to listen to us speaking and understand on an academic level, yes, life is better when I stop. But actually applying that in a practical way and really understanding it on a personal level does take time. Takes experience.
I love the way in your books, William, that a bit like this podcast, there's no bull. You talk about alcohol in quite, well, it's just a really honest way. And he says, the problem with your drinking is it makes us look like idiots. So as Freddie said at the opening of the podcast, you know, he thought he looked a bit like James Bond, you know, with his whatever on the rocks. And one point you made, which made me howl and wince at the same time, you say, ask your children what drinking does to you. This time last year, I went on my first ever alcohol-free mini break, and I took our middle daughter, just me and the teenage daughter, which, you know, it's a challenge at the best of times having teenagers. You know what that's like. It was one of the best breaks I've ever had because it was alcohol-free. And we were chatting in this beautiful bar overlooking the beach in Menorca, and she just turned to me and she said, you were such a bellend when you were drinking.
Put an explicit tag on this podcast episode. So,
William, that's a quote for you. Alcohol Explained 3.
I was going to just quickly add onto Shaz's point, and I totally agree with that. And I know there are many, many videos and photos of me out there in the world of the internet, in various stages of inebriation and probably undress as well, but that's probably for another podcast. But I've had that as well. And you know, I think anyone that's been drinking and anyone that's been on social media, there's going to be photos and videos of them drunk. And I've been there, and it's a horrible situation, especially, Steve, we've talked about the kids, but also for your friends. And you know, having people say, oh, look at this video of you. And yeah, you know, some of them, to be honest, I can't watch, and I still haven't watched because I was so, I'm not embarrassed of the situation, because I can do stupid things sober as well. So it's not about that. But it's about, you know, just seeing that I'd allowed myself to be in that position and that state. And I know sometimes a lot of people, they'll laugh it off and they'll say, ha ha, yeah, wasn't that hilarious? But I also know inside that it hurts. And it's like a massive flashing warning sign in front of you saying that thing that you were doing, and you know deep down inside that that's not cool, but it almost emphasizes the point that we need to change our behaviors. And I think it's so powerful, either getting that reflection from family or children or friends and seeing yourself as others see you through their eyes. It can really be a powerful motivator.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's absolutely right, because how we see ourselves when we're drinking is not the reality. It's not how other people see us at all.
And it's funny as well, and I think you mentioned it in your book as well, that it was something around, you know, a sober person can tell when another person's drunk, but a drunk person can't tell when someone else is sober. And it is like that. And we get so caught up in what people are thinking about us, and am I still going to look cool if I'm not drinking, and all those things. But it does just give us such clarity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. Yeah. The self-image, I think, is quite a big thing for people, because again, that can be a stumbling block for people, because when we're drinking, we work really hard on creating this image of how cool and great we are when we're drinking, and how it's an integral part of our personality. So quitting drinking, people often do it without really rethinking their self-image, which can cause a bit of a conflict then, because they still kind of see themselves as what they perceive as a drinker, so like rebellious and all the rest of it, but they don't necessarily tie in with reality.
We're just going to take a very short break from this episode of Over the Influence. It's another cracker. Absolutely brilliant. Loving it, as per usual. One aspect of our community that our members love, and we get a lot of feedback on this, is the forums. Here you can post your alcohol-free successes. You can share the smallest of wins, the biggest of wins, and we don't mind if you share the rubbish bits too. The forums are incredibly supportive. Everybody is welcome to post in there, to celebrate, commiserate, to get you going again, to cheer you on your way, and as well to celebrate those all important milestones. It doesn't matter if it is 7 days or 7 months or even 7 years. We have got members within the community at all stages of their alcohol-free journey. It's all shared in the forums. It's all kept private. It is so positive and it's a great deal of fun as well. If you want more information about what we do, just take a look at overtheinfluence.co.uk or feel free to contact us direct. We reply to all our emails, otihq@overtheinfluence.co.uk. Let's get back to the episode.
William, do you feel society shifting? And the reason I ask you, say about kind of, you know, adverts, whether it's on TV, billboards, whatever, people happily drinking, laughing, this is the way we all socialise in this country, you do it too, kind of thing. But, I mean, for me, giving up drinking is associated, in my head, initially, before we started doing this, with alcoholics. I would not class myself as an alcoholic, or wasn't an alcoholic. I drank too much, but I'm not giving up because I'm addicted to it. I'm giving up alcohol because life's better without it. Do you see that in what you do? Are you seeing different types of people coming through and different types of people engaging with what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so when the book was first published 5 years or so, so we're talking about quite close time scales here. We're not talking about the last 20 years or something. It was a very, very different world to where things are now. And I think that's exactly it. The original way of approaching it was, am I alcoholic? If yes, try and quit. If no, carry on happily. And that's just not the question people are asking themselves these days. People are asking themselves, quite rightly, am I getting more out of this than I'm putting in? And when they start to understand the dynamics, the answer is no. Absolutely not. And like you've found yourself, quitting is just, it's a choice about making just a better and happier life. It's not a choice of, I love this substance, but it keeps beating me down, therefore I have to give it up. It's a positive lifestyle change. And I do think there is a shift in society. So 200 years ago, you could walk into a chemist and you could buy morphine and cocaine and you just bought it, and they'd sell mixtures to quieten infants down to stop them crying that had morphine in it and laudanum and all sorts. So people didn't really understand about drugs, so you could just go and buy them. Now, over the years, we've understood that the apparent benefits to all of these substances are totally false. And the downsides far, far outweigh any apparent benefit. So we've slowly made them illegal and tried to cut them down. But two drugs above any other, alcohol and nicotine, have kind of managed to stand alone and just keep going. Nicotine's being pushed more and more to the periphery. But alcohol, I often describe it as the last great bastion of acceptable drug addiction, which is exactly what it is, to such an extent that people don't see it as a drug. They just don't think drinking is drug addiction.
William, it's the only thing you have to justify not consuming when you go out. If you said, I've given up cigarettes, people go, well done you. If you say, I'm not going to do some class A drugs tonight, people go, every credit. You say, I'm not drinking alcohol, and they lose their freaking minds.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's it. But even so, I think there is a shift. And I think when you look at trends among like millennials and younger people, less and less of them are drinking. And as you say, Ben, more and more people are giving up, not because they've got a problem with alcohol per se, but because actually this substance is not what it's made out to be. It's not the great social elixir with very little downside that people think it is. And I think as that information becomes more and more widely available and understandable to people, that's shifting people's dynamic. So for me, everyone who ever picks up an alcoholic drink, they've got the pros and the cons. So on the pro side, they've got, you know, it's fun, it tastes good, it's sociable. On the downside, there's virtually nothing there unless they drink too much and get a hangover. Whereas actually, when people understand it more and more, they realize that even one or two drinks destroys your sleep. It creates anxiety. It increases your heart rate, which makes you feel tired and lethargic and stops you wanting to move around. And that's just one or two drinks. So now, as people understand the downside a lot more, they're making just better decisions about alcohol, which is, I don't want it.
It takes balls, though, don't you think?
Yeah, it does. I think the problem is we're still at a situation where, I forget what the figure is, but it's like 80 or 90% of the population drink. Mm. So we who have stopped are a minority. Mm. So when you go out, you do still have, oh, what, you're not drinking, and, you know, you're kind of having to justify it. But I just look at it that we're sort of the vanguard of the new wave of things, really. We're the people that have just picked up a bit quicker than everyone else on what is a positive lifestyle change.
If you don't mind me popping in again, I've got loads of stuff to ask. One of my favourite sayings, William, is that the opposite of addiction is connection. And you know when you sort of, if you were pregnant, you'd go and see, you'd go for a walk in the street and you'd see 10,000 pregnant women. If you were choosing a new dog, a new breed, you'd go for a walk and you'd see all those breeds of dogs. When you go sober and you announce it and you say, I'm stopped drinking, all of a sudden, all these new people come out and they go, that's me as well. Oh my God, somebody else is doing it. Somebody else is doing it. I love the new connections that sobriety brings and the new people you meet and the new things that you try. And it does make you brave, and it does connect you with people that maybe you would never have even dreamed of speaking to in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've made a whole different social group of friends just from quitting drinking. But I've also found that I always thought of myself as really antisocial and introverted, and I think I kind of am to a degree, but bizarrely enough, I think drinking actually made it worse, because I did, like, when I went out, I wasn't interested so much in the socializing, I was interested in the drinking, and that was the big thing for me. But having quit, I actually find that I'm talking to people not because I'm in a pub and they happen to be there, or because I'm at a party and we're both at the bar. I'm talking to people that I have a genuine connection, or, you know, something similar with them. And it's actually quite enjoyable talking to people you have a genuine connection with.
And you can remember it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you make a bit more sense and it's more enjoyable. So, yeah, funnily enough, I've found that quitting drinking has actually improved my social life dramatically.
I think what's linked to that as well, William, as we were saying earlier on about the hangover and the anxiety, and it's all very well, and I was certainly there to... You have the bit of Dutch courage, and you, in a work example, you'd be like, right, I've got to go into a room where I don't know anyone. So you have a few drinks and a few more drinks, and everyone's all great friends at the end of it. But then the next day, when you're sat in the meeting and your world's falling apart, and then you're just there in the corner like a grumpy so-and-so, because you think, I don't even want anyone to ask me what my name is, because I just can't handle that right now. And it's that massive swing between the extreme of being the life and soul of the party. But then you think, is that really worth it to have this fake persona? And then for 4 days afterwards to be like a hermit, not wanting to open the windows or the curtains or go outside or talk to anyone at all. It's much better having that more level perspective that's actually the real you as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that there's a chemical side to that as well, because so endorphins are what make us feel good. So it's a chemical the brain releases to make you feel good. And interestingly, humans get an endorphin boost when they're relaxed and socializing with other people, which is an interesting thing. And it tells us a lot about how much humans are actually supposed to or designed to interact with each other. But putting that to one side, we're also a product of society. So when we go out with other people, for example, in a work situation, you're kind of a bit nervous about talking to people and what they'll think of you and if you say something stupid. So the usual dynamic without alcohol is you go into a social situation and you feel a bit nervous. And then after a period of time, and that period of time is going to be different depending on how shy you are generally. If you're a shyer person, it will take longer. If you're more extroverted, it will be much shorter. But when you start to relax into the situation, you then get that endorphin rush and you start to really enjoy socializing. Now, what alcohol does is, it being a sedative, it can anesthetize that feeling of nervousness, which then gives you the endorphin rush. So a lot of people will say, I really miss the alcohol high. There isn't an alcohol high. It can allow you to get a high by letting you get those endorphins, by anesthetizing your nerves. But alcohol doesn't provide a high. It just provides you with a slightly dull tunnel vision feeling. If you just sit with no friends, no nothing, no TV, no music, and drink alcohol, it makes you feel slightly dulled and a bit confused and gives you kind of like a weird tunnel vision. It's not particularly enjoyable. It's only because we mix it with socializing and associate it with that endorphin rush that we think it's got this great benefit and it causes this wonderful feeling. But the problem is, this all feeds in on itself, because then if you go out when you're not drinking, you're not happy because you're not drinking. A lot of time, you know, say if you're a designated driver, you're not going out to enjoy yourself. You're going out because you have to, but you'd really rather be drinking, and you kind of sit there looking forward to the next time you can go out and drink. So because you're not relaxed, you don't get the endorphin buzz, which feeds into the myth that actually you need alcohol to have a good time. Whereas actually you can go out and have just as good a time and feel fantastic without actually touching a drop of it. But again, that comes into having to have that knowledge and to try and actually relax into the evening rather than, and to be honest, I did this myself when I first quit drinking, was just looked on social occasions as a penance.
I did the same thing, William. Sorry, Freddie, go on.
No, I was going to say, just to link to what you were saying about, you know, it's not about strength or willpower. And I think certainly, yeah, because I tried to stop drinking so many times before it finally clicked. And I thought about it when I was kept on failing, essentially. I was thinking about it as willpower. And I was literally there at the bar with my fingers gripping into the bar, leaving fingernail marks, thinking, you know, two more hours, get through this, two more hours, necking so many Diet Cokes. I'd be awake all night and just thinking, yeah, this is horrible, but you've got to hold out. But if you just try to think of it that way, then none of us have got unlimited willpower. And it is, as you were saying earlier, it's about thinking that this is about living that life I want to live. This is about being the best version of myself. And to do that, then I need to stop doing this. And I think that shift in mindset is so powerful, and also brightens and lightens social events so much more when you think this is the real way of enjoying it, not that it should be a penance or running an alcohol-free gauntlet that you're just trying to get to the end of.
There's just one more thing that I noted from the... Actually, I just quickly want to say this as well. I love the way you've written the book, because you've written it in such a way where you've actually considered that somebody is still drinking while they're reading your book. And so the pages, the paragraphs are all spaced out, aren't they? And wider margins and things like that. And it's an easy read. And I thought that was... I just thought it was really thoughtful, actually.
I remember sitting at work Googling, you know, drinking too much and all the rest of it, having, you know, been drinking ridiculous amounts over the weekend and being in complete bits, and like reading, I think, the Big Book online. but not being able to follow it because I was in such a mess. And I so when I published that, I kind of had in mind that I'd do it nice big writing and all spaced out.
Brilliant.
If someone was in a similar situation, they could, yeah, hopefully follow it a bit easier. I'm glad you noticed that.
I did. I thought it was great. I really liked it. And I'd just like to end on this point, actually. You say here, you need to see through the bull. You need to see through the lies and the hype that cover the ugly truth about drinking. And you also need to see through the hype and the ugly lies that cover the beautiful truth about sobriety. I think that was my favourite quote.
Thank you. Yeah, I think as much nonsense surrounds alcohol, a similar amount of nonsense surrounds sobriety. Because again, and you know, podcasts like this are working hugely to change that view, but there is still a kind of a, if you've stopped drinking, you know, you're either some kind of obsessive vegan-esque type person who's just more interested in clawing every possible extra day living rather than actually enjoying life, or you've had a serious problem with alcohol. And in fact, going back to what we were saying before, neither of them are true. It's just about having a far better, far more enjoyable life.
William, we have thoroughly enjoyed having you as a guest on Over the Influence. For me in particular, fangirling all my way through that. It's been a real pleasure to finally meet the guy behind Alcohol Explained, because it did what it said on the tin. You explained alcohol and I understood more about myself and my drinking than I ever thought possible. And in particular, Alcohol Explained too. So if you've not read that book, for me, and I think for Freddie as well, it's essential reading. It was brilliant. And just thank you so much, William, for sharing your thoughts and for being a guest on our podcast. It's been a delight.
Thank you for inviting me. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Hello, this is Ben, and you come to the end of another wonderful episode of Over the Influence. But of course, there's always stuff going on in our online community. Just go to overtheinfluence.co.uk to see everything that we've got going on. There's free blogs, free resources. Obviously, we've got all our connection side of it too. But I just wanted to quickly tell you before we end about our monthly masterclass sessions. If we've had a guest that we think is amazing and that they haven't been able to fit all that I want to talk about into a normal episode of the free podcast that you've just listened to, we invite them to be a masterclass guest where it's exclusive for our community members, and essentially we dig even deeper into their stories and remind them for their knowledge and their information. Look, they are fabulous. We've had Sarah Connolly do a masterclass for us in the past, Claire Pooley, William Porter. These are big names that give us their time because they want to help people like you. Look, go to overtheinfluence.co.uk and sign up as a community member now. There's so much other stuff going on as well. It's fabulous. We love it and we're really proud of it. That's it. Thank you for listening to this week's episode and see you again next week.